Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Elaine Weiss is a journalist and writer whose latest book is The Woman's Hour. It's about the struggle to amend the U.S. Constitution to allow women the right to vote. Elaine appeared at a virtual National Writer Series event, and she spoke with Traversity Record Eagle columnist and teacher Susan Odgers. Susan asked Elaine to start by talking a little bit about herself.
I'm married to a university professor, and he is a professor at Johns Hopkins University, a professor of physics and astronomy. And we have two grown children, Theodore, Teddy, and Abigail, Abby. And they are professionals in their own right. And I have worked much of my career as a journalist, and for the last decade or so as a nonfiction book author. So I think the training in journalism certainly helped my writing of nonfiction books. I think journalists often write history, often write those kind of books that tell us not only where we have been, but perhaps with hints of where we are now. And if journalists write the first draft of history, then I think narrative nonfiction writers write that second and third.
Elaine, both of us know that we start tonight's interview with great gratitude to our foremothers and sisters. And let's start by going back to the summer of 1920 in Tennessee. Kind of set the scene for us with the sensory impressions back then.
Sure. Now, let me explain why we would ever want to go to Nashville, Tennessee in the middle of summer of 1920. And that's because that is the scene for the final political battle over the 19th Amendment, which is the constitutional amendment which grants the vote to American women. And it's been seven decades that the suffragists have been fighting for this. And it was stalled for the federal amendment was stalled for 40 years in Congress. And it's finally emerged in 1919. It's gone out to the states for ratification. And now this is possibly the last state possible to ratify. And that means the 36th state. It takes 36 states, three quarters of the states in the Union. Then there were 48. And so American women are holding their breath and seeing whether Tennessee is going to ratify. And so all of the forces supporting ratification, supporting women's suffrage, also those who are opposing it, men and women, pour into Nashville. It's a particularly hot summer in Nashville. Everyone's complaining about the heat in the when I read their letters and their journals. It's a fraught time. The world has just emerged from a terrible, terrible catastrophe of World War I, what was then called the Great War. In America, there's enormous anxiety about what America's role should be in the world. There is a sense of wanting to isolate ourselves from the rest of the world. There is labor strife. There's actually been quite in fact, 2,000 labor actions in the past year around the country. And in Tennessee, there's been quite a bit. There's racial strife. There are riots, many, many riots that are racially motivated in cities and towns across the country. There's a lot of anxiety about immigration. Does this all sound familiar?
It does.
Very much what we're also facing today. So American women are looking to Tennessee to see whether they are going to have a voice in the 1920 presidential election, which is going to really set the direction of the nation for the next decade and longer than that. And American women want to be part of that. Now, women in 15 states can vote already because they have won the vote by their state action. But it's quite clear for those other states that they will never be given the vote by their states unless there's a federal amendment which will supersede all the state restrictions. And so in this heat, in this tension, in this sense of the suffragists are actually also divided. There are rifts in the suffrage movement. You have the presidential candidates, their minions coming in. You have political activists, you have corporate lobbyists, and they all pour into Nashville for what promises to be a huge fight.
Elaine, tell us a little bit about where the title of the book comes from.
The Woman's Hour. Yes, it has a very clear historical grounding. And that comes from towards the beginning of the suffrage movement. And something that I explained to my readers is that the suffrage movement actually emerges from the abolition movement. Most of the women we think of as the foremothers of the movement, Susan Anthony, Elizabeth Stanton, Lucretia Mott, Lucy Stone, are activists for abolition before they turn their attention to women's rights. And there is a real bond between these issues because both, of course, African Americans are enslaved at this time. American women have no legal rights. And so there is this sense of the spark of divinity is in all people, and we should work towards the freedom of all Americans and the right to vote. We are a democracy after all. And so the abolition movement and the suffrage movement are like sibling causes through the Civil War. And afterwards, there will be a break only because they're pitted against one another. And Congress says, well, no, only one group can get the vote. And we often see this, powers putting disenfranchised and powerless and voiceless citizens against one another to lessen their power and to divide them. And this is what happens after the Civil War. And the nation is told that the suffragists and the abolitionists who've been working so closely together are told, no, the nation cannot handle two big reforms at once, can only do one. The woman's hour has not arrived. The woman's hour will have to wait. And so it'll be another 50 years until, as Carrie Chapman Catt, who's one of the lead characters in my book, she's the president of the mainstream suffrage organization in the nation, and she declares the woman's hour has now struck. And so that's where the title comes from.
I'm wondering if you've been able to meet any of the descendants of the key players in your book. Can you tell us about that?
Well, yes, that's always the fun part. Now, of course, when you write history of a century ago, and of course, my story begins in the middle of the 19th century, so I couldn't hope to really meet some of those characters. But I've been fortunate enough to meet several of their descendants. I've met Elizabeth Cady Stanton's great-great-granddaughter. I've met Carrie Catt's great-nephew in Iowa. One of the things I wanted to do in this book was to bring to light that this was not a movement of a couple of leaders back in the 19th century and then it was all done. It was a movement of millions of women and men. And it was, there were leaders in every town, in every city, and in every state. And I wanted to bring some of those to light, especially in Tennessee, and especially in some of the other organizations that were working towards suffrage besides the mainstream one, the national. And so there are some wonderful young women in their 20s who are on the front lines. And I got to meet some of their descendants. And in one, the great niece was able, had just donated her papers to the Schlesinger Library, the great library of American women's history at Harvard. And she allowed me to go through the unprocessed box. This is really exciting for a researcher. And to see some of the letters and the notes and the memoirs of her great aunt. And that was so wonderful because you get a sense of who these people are. And that again was one of my goals in this book. Again, when we read, if there's anything written about women's suffrage in our history texts, and there was not usually a lot, it's usually a sentence or two. It's usually American women asked for the vote at the Seneca Falls meeting in 1848. And then in 1920, they were given the vote. And that's about as far wrong as you can get. So I wanted to not only tell the history in a more realistic sense, the battle, the bitterness the extraordinary opposition that women confronted in trying to bring equality to American women, but also to let my reader understand that these were women and people, and they were not icons. They're not saints. They're not two-dimensional historical figures. You ask someone about women's suffrage, they usually can name Elizabeth Stanton, Susan Anthony, and that's it. And so I really did want my readers to understand these women, especially as people, their vanities, their insecurities, their enormous courage, their personal backgrounds. So as much as I can, I dug that up from the archives.
Well, Elaine, I think most of us think that we've had to do so much of our own work to learn our women's history for the very reasons you just described. And your three books do a tremendous job at helping us with that. So just on that point alone, I really want to thank you. Can you tell us a little bit about your writing process? How do you go about such a tremendous task?
Anyone who writes nonfiction, especially historical narrative nonfiction, begins in the library or begins in the archive. Research is the foundation of this. And I will, since this is a writer's series, I'll share with you one of my favorite reactions, only because it's kind of interesting, but I do get letters from readers and comments when I tour around, and people say to me, wow, I just loved your novel. And I thank them because it's a great compliment. I consider it a great compliment. And so I thank them, and I then have to explain. I said, if it reads like a novel, I am very, very happy. But I have to explain to you that I couldn't make anything up, that there are 750 endnotes at the end. You don't have to read them, but they're there. And everything I have put in the book has been cited, and I have the source, and I can't make up anything, any dialogue, any action of my, so I'm restricted like that, but there's a great world you can describe. And so I'm in the archives. That's where I am. I have to first find where the material is. And that's usually a great hunt. I mean, that's the exciting, it's treasure hunting. You find where material is, and then you have to go there, and you spend very intense days. Usually you stay in the cheapest motel, and you work night and day in the archives. And again, it's been very interesting to see the technology change as I've researched the book, my books, how you can get things digitally now, but you still have to be in the archive. A lot of the deeper stuff has not been digitized. So I'm in the archives. If I'm lucky, I can then buy microfilm and bring it home and use it at my husband's university. And I spend months in airless, windowless rooms in the microfilm reader, and your eyes kind of get cross-eyed. So that's the first part. And then at a certain point, you have to say, even though this is great fun, I have to start writing. And there's always that moment, and every writer has their own moment when they realize they have to start writing. And it doesn't mean you ended the research, because you're always going back. You're always filling in missing parts. But then you have to start assembling it, organizing it, making it retrievable, starting to build your narrative arc. And that's when the fun begins, and that's when the real work begins for a writer of historical nonfiction. And I love it. I love both parts of it. I often think of it as a joke with my friends that I'm writing journalism with dead people, which really means that I use a lot of those skills of building a story, of hearing the voice of my source. And I can't interview them, but I do have their letters, their memoranda, their quotations in newspapers, their sometimes autobiographies. Those are very rare, actually, from what I can find. But they do sometimes have, retrospective things they've written. And so I do have their voices, but I have to gather them in a different way. And then I have to write it as any writer would put together a vivid story. In this book, in The Woman's Hour, I had to use techniques I'd never used before. And I had to learn how to use them, especially suspense. Okay. Now, you know, there's whole genres of writers who use suspense all the time, but I, as a writer of history, had never had to use that. And even as a journalist, had not had to use that. And so I had to learn how to, the pacing, the beats that you have to create so that your reader knows certain things at certain times and you withhold certain information from them. Because one of the things I had to do, everyone sort of knows how the story ends, the story I tell. We can vote, but I needed to make my readers forget that you know what happens. I needed to make you nervous. I needed to make you feel, wow, this might not pan out, because that's what the suffragists felt. So I had to make you feel hot and miserable and scared and frustrated and all those emotions that I know the suffragists in Nashville felt because I'm reading their accounts. Mm-hmm. So that was my job. And it was a little different than I had ever done before. So I had to learn a lot of writing techniques and pacing techniques that I never had to master before.
That's fascinating. Thank you for giving us all that. Yesterday, you and I were talking about some of the ironies that women could run for office, but they couldn't vote. And I'm wondering if you can tell us a few more of those disconnects that women have traveled with this topic.
Well, there are many. You know, when the movement begins to get traction, the idea of women's rights in the mid-19th century, it's instructive to know, to realize what women couldn't do. I mean, it's almost hard for us to fathom. It's not just the vote. It is that women have no property rights. Now, this is dictated by state law, but in general, they had few, if any, property rights. And a married woman especially had absolutely no rights to the wealth she brought into the family, or the land she brought into the family. They belonged to her husband. Any wages or any property she gained after the marriage belonged to her husband. Her children belonged to her husband. She had no custodial rights. So if she left the marriage, she left the children. She was not allowed to testify in a court of law, or to serve on a jury, or to bring about a civil action. She had no legal rights in that way. She was, as the suffragists called, civilly dead. And so, of course, she couldn't attend most universities or colleges or professional schools. The clergy, everything was pretty much closed to her. This improves as the 19th century progresses. But there were some things, again, this is all in state law, which were not prohibited. And so it meant that in many cases, women could actually run for office, even though they couldn't vote. Now, the reality was, who was going to vote for a woman for any kind of political office, and until women could also vote? But there are some interesting examples. Women in some states are allowed to run for school board, because that's considered an extension of the home, you know, education of children. And so they're able to vote in school board elections, some in some states, and to run for school board. So there's, you see women entering the political arena in that way. There's a wonderful story I tell in the book of Elizabeth Cady Stanton running for Congress in 1866 in New York. And of course she loses, but she thanks her 13 male friends who voted for her. And so you see this, there are women running, once, especially in the Western states, women do win the suffrage by state action. You see women running for Congress, for Senate, right away. It's hard for them to get any traction, but they start. And of course, the first woman who serves in Congress, Jeanette Rankin from Montana, because Montana women can vote. And so that's an explanation. It's also true that there are about 5 or 7 women in state legislatures by the time 1920 when ratification occurs.
Okay. You and I know that over 408,000 people have died from COVID-19. We have the protests related to George Floyd. We have long lines in the Georgia vote. Tell me and our audience some of the concerns and hopes you have for our democracy.
Well, that's a tall order, but it's true that my story is relevant, and I don't, I wish it wasn't as relevant. I wish it was just a sweet, important story of history. But it's not just that, because the fight for voting rights is not over. The fight for inequality and racial equality is not over. You know, the 19th Amendment does give the vote to all American women. But as we know, it did not extend to women of color in certain states. And I want to explain that because it's important. The 19th Amendment does say you cannot be denied the vote on account of sex. In the southern states, that will be subverted by Jim Crow laws that make it harder for Black women to vote. Of course, the 15th Amendment guaranteed the vote to Black men in 1870, and the southern states had managed to disenfranchise them. So until the Voting Rights Act of 1965 put some legal teeth into enforcement, and Congress never has the right to enforce this and never does. So let's put the blame where it deserves. And in the Southern legislatures, there are these Jim Crow laws, which will make it, poll taxes and literacy tests and onerous hurdles to voting, which are backed up by violence and intimidation. And again, we'll talk about Native American women who are also not allowed to vote after 1920 because Native Americans are not considered citizens until afterwards. And then, even after the federal government says they can, the states are very slow until I believe it's 1860. I get my centuries a little mixed up. 1962, that all Native peoples who are citizens are allowed to vote. And then Asian American men and women do not get the vote until late 1940s. We're in 2020 and voting rights is still an issue. We saw those lines in Georgia. You know, we saw them in other states before. We're facing probably an election by mail because of COVID and the danger of people gathering in polling places. The suffragists had to face a pandemic in 1918 and 1920. They had to curtail a lot of their campaigning. But I think the important lesson is that this fight for voting rights is not over. It wasn't over in 1920. It wasn't even over in 1965 when the Voting Rights Act, the enforcement clause, the fifth clause, was eviscerated by the Supreme Court in 2013 in the Shelby County versus V. Holder decision. And now we see an explosion of voting rights restrictions and suppression measures in the states. And I think we as a nation have to make it loud and clear that this is not acceptable. Voting rights isn't a partisan issue. I know it's being tried to be portrayed as a partisan issue. It is not. And it's a, as I call it, a stress test of the health of our democracy. And are we willing to let that go? We fight wars for democracy. And yet I think we need to rise up, as we saw wonderful protests around America about injustice. We need to stand up for voting rights as part of this sense of injustice, because the voting restrictions are being targeted to minority communities. So this is a civil rights issue. It's still a civil rights issue. Suffrage is always a civil rights issue. And I think we need to understand what we're confronting today.
Thanks, Elaine. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone who is with us tonight. I just want to encourage you to go to your local bookshops and buy Elaine's books. Thank you so much, everyone. Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
That was Elaine Weiss talking with Susan Odgers, and you're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up in the second half, a discussion with the author of a popular mystery series and standalone novels, William Kent Krueger.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. In the second half of our program today, we'll hear a discussion with William Kent Krueger. He's the author of the Cork O'Connor series of mystery novels, and his latest book is a standalone novel called This Tender Land. I talked with William during a National Writer Series virtual event, and I asked him to tell me about his new book.
This Tender Land takes place in the summer of 1932, deep in the Great Depression. It's the story of four orphans running from the law because they've committed a terrible crime, but for the right reason. They know if they take to the roads to get away, they'll be caught quickly because a huge manhunt has been launched to capture them. They're afraid to ride the rails, as everybody was doing back in the Great Depression, because the railroads back then were patrolled by private cops called bulls. And the bulls had a reputation for being incredibly cruel. So the kids are afraid to ride the rails. Instead, they decide to take to the rivers. They canoe a river called the Gilead to the Minnesota River. They canoe the Minnesota to the Mississippi. And their plan is to canoe all the way down the Mississippi River to St. Louis, where they believe they have family and they'll be safe. I've always wanted to write an updated version of Huckleberry Finn. This is my Huckleberry Finn.
I happen to agree. Also, I think you're a fan of Charles Dickens.
Indeed.
And perhaps of Homer.
Yeah, you'll find those influences definitely throughout the story.
In fact, the protagonist of This Tender Land is named what?
Odysseus. Odie O'Banion.
Odie O'Banion. Now, come to us tonight with a really interesting background. You know, you moved around as a young child. Your father was a high school English teacher. He then went to work for an oil company. But I think you were born in Wyoming, but ended up graduating from high school in Oregon. And you now live in Minnesota. Do I have that right?
Close, but no cigar.
Yeah.
I graduated from high school. I spent most of my high school years in Oregon, but I actually graduated from high school in the San Joaquin Valley in California. Yet another move my family made.
It's interesting that your work with the Cork mystery series and with Ordinary Grace and with This Tender Land focus so deeply on place, and particularly a place that you've come to love, which you moved to, I think, in your 30s, roughly. Talk to us a bit about how this place has its hooks in you. And because many of us listening here in the National Writer Series audience, I think we'll respond to that.
Yeah. So among the many places I lived as we were moving around as a family were several years spent in Ohio. I lived in both cities, small towns, and on a couple of farms in Ohio. And that's really where the Midwest sunk its hooks into me. You know, Doug, you're Midwestern. I think if the Midwest, once you get it in your blood, it's always going to draw you back. So although I went to many other places, beautiful places, Oregon, I'm not sure there's a more beautiful place on the face of the earth than Oregon. For whatever reason, they didn't speak to me in the same way that the Midwest has always spoken to me. And when I returned to Minnesota, returned to my Midwest roots, really so much of the inspiration for my writing has come out of that return and this renewed love that I have for the heartland.
You've told us what happens in this tender land when I asked what you thought the book was about, but you said something so interesting about what I think is the heart, the beating heart of the book, which is you've written, should you ask me what I wanted readers to take most from this story, I would say that it was simply this. If we hold together as family, as friends, as fellow human beings, our journey will always take us to the place our hearts know is home. And is this novel about 1931 lands in this present moment of 2020, make some think moment about why this book is so popular at this moment. What is resonating with so many readers across the country right now in a book about the Depression era?
Well, if you look at the situation during the Depression and the situation that exists today, there are certainly many parallels. In the Great Depression, lots of people were out of work. Look at today. During the Great Depression, we had a significant homeless population. Look out there today. During the Great Depression, there was an enormous disparity between those who had plenty and those who had nothing. Look at today. I'm just reminded of the old saw, the more things change, the more they stay the same. But I wrote this Ordinary Grace. I set out to write in this tender land a novel of hope. And I wanted, across the course of this journey, for our young vagabonds, our four orphans, to experience the whole gamut of the human response to great privation. They meet people who fold in on themselves and do their best to protect what's important to them, as well as those people who have very little and yet find the grace in their hearts to share what little they have with those who have less. And I think we see exactly the same tendencies in play today. My own belief is that in the end, those who open their hearts make all of the difference. Otherwise, we would have destroyed ourselves a very long time ago.
Yeah, I completely agree. You talk a lot about grace. And I was curious, reading both Ordinary Grace and This Tender Land, the role that spirituality plays in your life privately, if you've ever talked about that. I know that the characters, for instance, Odie in This Tender Land is befriended by Sister Eve, traveling revival show. Talk to us a moment, because it's not a normal topic for a crime writer, so to speak, to address.
Yeah, and as a result, when I attend crime conferences, I'm always put on the panel of religion and crime. Although I never think of my work as religious. It really is, as you have pointed out, more spiritually based. I believe we are all on a spiritual journey, whether we embrace this or not. And my own spiritual journey, the direction it is taking me, has been an issue for me my whole life, trying to understand that journey. And so many, very often, if you read my Cork O'Connor series, you're very often going to see in those 17 novels an undercurrent that deals with the spiritual journey. It's something that comes very naturally for my protagonist, Cork O'Connor, because he's a man of mixed heritage. He's part Irish-American and he's part Ojibwe, the largest tribal affiliation here in northern Minnesota. So he's a man with a foot in two different spiritual traditions, his white Catholicism, he's Irish Catholic, and his Ojibwe spirituality. So very often in those stories, he's trying to figure out where his unique spiritual path lies, and that's been an issue for me my whole life. When I decided to embark on a very risky project that resulted in Ordinary Grace, one of the reasons I wanted to write that story was I believed it would allow me to dig more deeply into the whole question of the importance of this spiritual journey that we're on. And that struggle to understand God and the great mystery that is God. Here in Minnesota, the Ojibwe word for the Great Spirit is Kitchimanidu, which means Great Spirit. But I prefer the more poetic translation that a number of my Ojibwe friends have given me, the Great Mystery, because it is a great mystery. And so my characters are often struggling to wrap their understanding around this great mystery. And that's certainly true of Odie O'Banion as he tries to juggle the two images, the two very diverse images of God, the tornado God, the destructive God, that Old Testament God, and the more loving, graceful, forgiving God that Sister Eve, the image Sister Eve offers him.
Yeah, what I hope to communicate to those watching us tonight is that there is a sense in reading this Tender Land that we're watching people being selfless, that they often have very little and they try to give back a lot. Now, at the same time, your characters meet a villainous crew of varying degrees of wickedness. And it's a really, it's a really expansive and warm read, but it's also, you know, it is a page turner. How you go from writing the mysteries to these two standalone novels is an interesting moment for me. And I wonder if it's part of this quote, spiritual journey you're talking about, because I know that you started writing when you were 30 roughly, and maybe we can get back to that in a moment, but I think you had written Ordinary Grace, and that was quite a hard sell on your part for the publisher to let them have you leave a 14 series mystery. Go ahead and tell us about that.
Well, that's an interesting journey, one with a very spiritual heart to it, I believe. So I've been writing the Cork O'Connor novels. They've been very successful. They were New York Times bestselling novels, and I had created a significant following for that series. But I had been seeking a story that would allow me to, again, probe the question of the spiritual journey more deeply. And when the idea began to really coalesce for me in a way that I realized I could write this story, I proposed the project to my publisher, and they were not particularly excited about it. In fact, they kind of called me out to New York City and sent me down and said, "Kent, we only want Cork O'Connor novels from you."
What did you say to them when they said that to you?
Well, that's okay. You know, what can I say? I'm not going to try to talk you into something you don't want, because I didn't have the story together at that point. I had not written the manuscript. And it was one of the great freedoms that I had in writing this manuscript was the fact that it was not under contract. I could write any kind of story I wanted to write. I didn't have to worry about pleasing anyone except myself. And I got to tell you, that was so liberating. So when it took me 3 years to complete the manuscript, working in and among the contractual obligations for my Cork O'Connor series. And when that manuscript was finished, even though my publisher had said they didn't want it, I went ahead and sent it to my editor at Simon & Schuster. She fell in love with it. She said, "Of course, we're going to publish this." And they did. And Ordinary Grace has had this really remarkable, very gratifying reception from readers and critics alike. It won tons of awards when it came out. It's been translated into a couple of dozen languages. So far, it's sold nearly a million copies. And when my publisher saw how well that book was doing, boy, did they want another one just like it. So I signed a contract for a companion novel. I spent the next 2 years writing that. And that manuscript, Doug, was contractually due to my publisher 5 years ago. 2 months before that contractual deadline, I set up a meeting in Chicago to talk to my agent about revisions to the piece, because there were problems with it. I knew it, she knew it. 2 days before we met, I sent her a note saying, "When we get together, I don't want to talk about how we revise this piece. I want to talk about how we keep it from being published." Because it wasn't the story I thought it would be. I didn't know how to make it that story. And frankly, my heart wasn't in it. It turns out my publisher was quite understanding. They said, "Fine, you don't have to give us this manuscript, but you still owe us a companion novel." So here's what was going on, Doug. The expectations for that follow-up novel were enormous. And the whole time I was trying to write the story, I just felt crushed by the weight of all those expectations. But once that weight got lifted off my shoulders and I felt free again, I saw very clearly the story I should have been writing. And it was a story that I have wanted to write since I was 11 years old. When I was 11 years old in the fifth grade, toward the end of that year, our teacher read to the class The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. She did it by reading half an hour after lunch every day. I loved The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. Here was this kid who was just like me and was having these great adventures out there on the Mississippi River. And of course, after that, I had to read Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, which I also loved. So across the whole course of my career as a writer, I have always wanted to write a book that would pay homage to Mark Twain and his inspiration.
Interesting. That, what was the lifting of the expectations? The book didn't get canceled, but it's basically kind of evaporated. And
yeah, and they had no idea what I was going to write after that. You know, I love my publisher. God, I love my publisher. They didn't push me at all until I was ready to show them what I had created. Of course, in the meantime, I was delivering on time all of my contractual obligations in the Cork O'Connor series. But I honestly believe that the freedom that they offered me is part of the reason I was able to create the story that I so love and that so many readers have embraced as well.
Were you, from the time that you went to Minnesota, what were you doing during those 10 years? Were you on your own quest? Because let's be honest, this Tenderland is a quest journey right out of, say, Joseph Campbell, you know, the hero with 1,000 faces here. This is a very archetypal kind of journey, which I think, yet it's so resonant and so precise at the same time. But what were you doing in those 10 years? Did you feel lost?
I have never felt lost. I have always been writing. Writing has always been my grounding. I'm a very disciplined writer, and I have been for the last 40 some odd years. Here's my regime, Doug. My alarm clock goes off. Well, it doesn't go off anymore because I have trained myself to get up a bit in advance of 6 o'clock every morning, 7 days a week. I get myself dressed. Before the coronavirus kept us sheltering in place, I would go to a coffee shop and spend the first couple, sometimes even 3 hours, writing. That was a process I began when my wife entered law school because I suddenly became the sole support of the family. I was the guy who had to keep a roof overhead and food on the table, but I also wanted to be a writer. And I needed to come up with a way to meet my responsibilities and also develop as an artist. It was Hemingway, guy I loved when I was much younger, who showed me the way. One of the things I knew about Hemingway was is that he loved nothing better than to rise at first light and spend the first couple of hours of every day writing. He thought it was the most creative time of the day. At that point in time, my wife and I were living a couple of blocks from this really iconic cafe in St. Paul called the St. Clair Broiler, which opened its doors at 6 o'clock every morning. So I pitched this idea to my wife. I said, Diane, if you're willing to get the kids up and dressed and fed and off to school so that I can go write at the broiler first thing every day, I swear to you, when I come home from my job at the end of the day, I will be the best husband, the best father you can possibly imagine. She bought it. So there I was at the broiler every morning at 6 o'clock with my pen and my notebook in hand. Pen and notebook, because this was long before we had laptops. They would seat me in booth number 4, always booth number 4. They saved it for me. They would pour me my coffee. I'd open up my notebook, pick up my pen, and from 6 till 7:15, I would write. At 7:15, I closed my notebook, paid for my coffee, went out front, and at 7:20, a bus picked me up and took me to the university where I was working. So I followed that regime day in and day out for decades, and it did two things for me, Doug. The first thing was it helped me establish that discipline that I think is necessary to every artist. I don't care what your medium is. But it did something else for me that was even more important, and here it is. When I look back at that time, I realized if I wrote first thing in the morning, I was feeding something in me that needed to be fed and that gave me the energy to go out and give to the world whatever I had to give to it to keep a roof overhead and food on the table because I'd taken care of something elemental to who I am. What I realized was that writing had become the way I centered myself in every day and created the energy to go out and meet the world. And that's still one of the great blessings that comes to me from my writing.
So storytelling is important in society. It's an important engine in gathering us together, I think. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Cultures are based around stories, the stories they tell that offer them the cultural norms, that offer them really the basic how-tos of day-to-day living, all of those things. Stories do a great deal more than entertain us. Stories enlighten us. They encourage us. They inspire us, but maybe the most important thing that stories can do for us is they give us hope. And that's one of the things whenever I write a story, I set out to do. I want to make it a hopeful story.
It's interesting how you say that, though, but when we think of a crime novel, hope isn't the first word that springs to mind. How did you square that with yourself? I know that your protagonist, Cork, is a certain kind of soul, but I think you consciously chose, you said, if I'm going to put a roof over my head and be a writer, I'm going to, because you didn't know much about mysteries to begin with, is that correct?
I knew nothing about mysteries when I started to write them.
How did you teach yourself?
I mean, well, how did that came about? You know, my father, a high school English teacher, turned me on to Hemingway when I was 18. And I loved Hemingway. And I tried for way too long to try to write the great American novelist. Hemingway might have written it. But I hit my early 40s in a midlife crisis and thought, the hell with trying to write the great American novel. I want to write something somebody might want to read. And I looked around me to see what everybody reads. And you know what everybody reads, Doug? They read mysteries. So I decided I'm going to write a mystery. Knew nothing about mysteries because my father had done his best to raise all of his children on, you know, literature with a capital L. So I didn't even read the Hardy Boys or Nancy Drew when I was growing up. So I had a lot to learn. We have this wonderful resource here in the Twin Cities. It's called The Loft. It is the largest independent center devoted to the written word in the United States. And they teach all kinds of classes. And so I took a class that was basically Mystery Writing 101. It worked. I wrote the first chapter of my first published novel in the Cork O'Connor series in that class.
Iron Lake, you wrote in that
class? Yep.
Really? If you could look down from outer space and maybe you can. Maybe. what story is being written today? What is the story of today that needs to be told?
I think it's the same old story. It's the hero's journey. I mean, Campbell caught that beautifully. He understood that there is an archetype in us all that is always striving for truth, that is always striving for the ultimate good. We may not know that truth, we may not know that ultimate good, but that really is, that's the holy grail that we are searching for. And I think we're still at work on that today. And I look around me and I see all of this chaos, but you know what else I see? I see in the aftermath, and I saw that here in St. Paul with all of the looting and the rioting that took place, which was just a mile from my home, three blocks from my daughter's home. The very next day after the buildings had been burned and the shooting had happened and all of that chaos had occurred, the very next morning, the whole community came together. Black neighbors, white neighbors, Latinx neighbors, Asian neighbors. They came with their shovels and their rakes and their bags, and they were cleaning up the debris. They were already beginning the work of healing the wounding. And that's, I think, the story. I hope that that will come out of this, the story that as human beings here we're writing.
Hmm. Given where we are today, given where just in kind of physically masked up and not able to gather, how do you write into the future? What are the rules? Does Cork wear a mask? And if he doesn't, does that mean that he is not living in the same world we are? Talk about that. How do we as storytellers adjust to this?
Well, there are those storytellers who write contemporary stories, and I'm not one of them. My Cork O'Connor series is really about 5 years behind the times.
Right. This one's a prequel. Go ahead and talk about
it. Yeah, the most recent novel that I have completed, a novel called Lightning Strike, number 18 in the Cork O'Connor series, is a prequel to the series. So it goes way back. It goes back to the early 1960s when Cork was an adolescent. And I have to tell you, I kind of prefer writing about the past than I do about the present, because I don't think we understand the present in the present moment unless we are incredibly wise, because we can't, generally speaking, most of us can't see into the future, and we don't really know where we're going. And until we've gone there and have a moment to look back, I don't think that we really understand who we were. I don't think we really understand where we're going.
It's interesting, you know, This Tender Land is bookended with an older voice of an older man, which is Odie O'Banion, right? Looking backwards. And so you've just perfectly kind of describe the manifold experience of that novel. It seems to me that what's interesting to you or your novels is a sense of perspective, a sense of figuring out the past. Or you have a character, Emmy has what I guess are epileptic seizures, and sister Eve seems to think she can see the future or perhaps change it. That must have been a fun bit to write in the novel.
Well, one of the things I like about fiction is you can do anything you want to as long as you, as long as you create a reality around it for the reader. So Emmy is a seer. She sees into the future, and Emmy even has the ability, perhaps, to tweak the future. Sister Eve has the ability to touch someone and understand their past, where they've come from, what it is in their hearts that they most desire. My mother was a seer. She has always, across the course of her life, had dreams that were premonitions. So I am so willing to accept. As Odie says, open your heart to every possibility, for there's nothing we can imagine that is not so.
Is there anything you'd like to say to our audience in closing here? We're coming to the end of, it's hard to believe.
This has gone so fast.
I know that I want to say, please buy This Tender Land at your local favorite bookstore. I will tell you that I read it in a day or two, and I fell into it as a welcome respite from the news of the world. Although the news of the world in This Tender Land is not good. It is a world fraught. But what was so, Ken, what was so satisfying was watching people solve problems and trying to do the right thing at the most difficult moment, and often hitting the mark. You know, and that is the cathartic role that you as a storyteller played for me. So thank you.
You are so welcome. And if I had anything to say to all of the people out there is, if you haven't read This Tender Land, oh, please read it. If you've read This Tender Land but have not read Ordinary Grace, oh, please read that. And if you have never tried one of my Cork O'Connor books, please pick up one of those.
I couldn't agree more. Well, listen, you're a delight. Thank you for sharing yourself and your stories with us. And thank you.
Thanks so much, Doug. I so appreciated this evening and so enjoyed it.
That was William Kent Kruger talking with Doug Stanton. His latest novel is This Tender Land. In the first half of the program, we heard from Elaine Weiss talking with Susan Odgers. Elaine's latest book is The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlock in Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerrick.